Welcome to the Christie's Education Podcast, Jet Streams, hosted by Michael Plummer. We will be presenting a series of conversations with thought leaders that provides a 40,000-foot view of the art world as it continues to reconfigure after the pandemic. At a time when new trends are converging and economic forces are changing, many art market participants are asking, what's next? We will be speaking to leading thinkers who are drawn from a cross-section of the global art world, from collectors to journalists, from museum directors and curators to artists, from dealers to auction house executives, from writers to art financiers and advisors. We will get their views right here.
Hello, I'm Michael Plummer. We are here at One Rockefeller Plaza for the inaugural podcast of Jet Streams. Today, we have as our guest an award-winning journalist, Kelly Crow. Hello, Kelly.
Hi.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Kelly is a staff reporter for the Wall Street Journal, covering the art market from major auction sales at Christie's, Sotheby's, Phillips, and other houses, to analysis of the funding and art buying activities of the world's major museums, art fairs, artists, and collectors around the world. Kelly has covered the art market for the Journal since 2006. How time has passed.
I know, we're all getting old. I'm getting old now. Luckily, I don't sound old on camera, so this is great. On radio, I sound great.
Yes, indeed. So, welcome to Jet Streams. We are delighted to have you here. Before we start, I want to discuss a unique aspect of your background that I suspect may contribute to your great reporting on the art market, and how spending some time with the interesting figures at the pinnacles of it, like that happy-making picture of you and Yussi that you posted on Instagram on his last day on the podium, that I think gives you a unique perspective, that you came from a smallish community in Oklahoma. I come from a smallish community in central Pennsylvania. And I think it gives people like us a unique outlook, and sometimes perhaps even a more objective outlook on the art world. So I look forward to some of your thoughts today on what just happened over the last couple of weeks in the month of November, the bellwether evening sales. So let's get down to brass tacks and talk about what everyone else has been talking about. What really did happen at those sales, those auctions here earlier in the month of November? Are we in a downturn? Are we not? It seems there's not a consensus on either side. How do we read these tea leaves? And hopefully you'll help us decipher them. When we last spoke, that in some ways you were still digesting, which I can understand. I think a lot of us are. What's your initial take from the 40,000-foot view to start, and then we'll drill down from there?
Sure, let's unpack it. Well, first of all, thank you for having me on the podcast. And yes, I am from Oklahoma, and I do feel like being from the middle gives me hopefully kind of an outsider looking in perspective. The art world is super insular and has, you know, for a long time been kind of clubby and bespoke, and it is the party you want to get into. You know, it is the ticket that you want to have. It is the painting on the wall that you want to be able to brag to other folks, but it also can be very intimidating and off-putting for folks who have maybe been successful in other realms, but don't sort of understand the emperor, much less his clothes. And so I think coming from the outside looking in, it's always sort of helpful for me to remember that mom and pop America loves art. They love going to museums, but they don't always get it. And I never want to make anyone feel stupider, right? I always want them to feel included. And even if it's a little bit affectionately making fun of the things that we're seeing and doing in the world that we inhabit, I sort of want to have a foot in both realms. And so that I can kind of be a little bit of a bridge or a guide. And I would say that has sort of been the defining mojo of how I have tried to report, is both to understand what the billionaires are buying and what the artists are making, and then also be able to explain that to, you know, the guy in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, so. And surely that must contribute to your longevity with the Journal.
Well, maybe that might be the Kool-Aid that I've been drinking, right? The Journal is known for that. They want to understand all the markets, and they also, yeah. I mean, I will still see sometimes in our paper, a stock is this, right? A share price is that. They really do try to bring everyone along. So that's, I've definitely absorbed that. But this season was tricky to sort of navigate because it's always easy when, you know, when the tides are rising just to say all the boats are floating and it's great, right? And here's how manically crazy the art world is. Yeah. And then when everything's just tanking, well, then that's a no-brainer. These waters are like choppy, but they're also not terrible. And so you're trying to figure out what that means for whom. And I think that also perfectly illustrates a truism that we always know and always forget, which is that it's not just one art market, right? It's not a monolith. And so in every season, hundreds of artists are coming up for their reckoning, whether or not they want to. And those price levels sort of recalibrate and we kind of draw different conclusions about where we're going. And it's almost more fun, but trickier to do it in a season when not everything's, you know, going like crazy. I will say heading into these sales, the low estimate, I believe, among the three houses was around $1.8 billion. And then in the end, I think they did around $2.2 billion. So, you know, they got over a hump and then some, which I think is important to note because there have been seasons when they didn't even meet their own expectations. That doesn't speak to profitability, but it does speak to sort of did they hit their target in terms of did the market absorb what it needed to? And I would say unequivocally that it did absorb it. So that's the first initial takeaway is they pulled it off.
Would you agree that it took quite a bit of skill and finesse on the part of the auctioneers in reading the temperature of the market and setting those estimates and collecting property for sale that would sell in an uncertain marketplace? That's no small feat. Is that not true?
No, the theatrics were on high alert, I think, this season for sure. The big ticket item, certainly the huge consignment that everyone was salivating over was Emily Fisher Landau's estate, right? Both houses were desperate for it. They desperately wanted it. Sotheby's snagged it this time. They made the best offer and they benefited from it. You know, I mean, they pulled it off. I believe the evening sale was 100% sold, right? White glove sale. The grand total was, you know, 406.4. So that's a hefty amount of money to sell, you know, from one consigner. Big thing, questionable whether or not they made a dime on it, to be honest, because, you know, they're guaranteeing everything and they're making sure that everything sold. So all of the love that goes for the $139 million Picasso, you know, like it kind of offsets some of the stuff that probably sold for, you know, for less. But that's, I think, across the spread, they probably were happy that they got it. Christie's, for its part, was sort of quietly freaking out. I'm told that they didn't land it, but that just made Alex Ritter and co, like, they went out and put together, I think, a pretty interesting sale.
I agree.
A mixed bag, but I think you could argue that it was a more interesting sale to watch because it was,
I agree,
right across all different tastes. It wasn't just one person's taste.
It was one of the more interesting various owner sales I've seen in a while, and exciting for that reason.
And it sold, I mean, if we're just looking at the numbers, to back their 20th Century evening sale then was, you know, $641 million. So, you know, I remember evening sales, you know, that didn't touch a third of that, right? And downturns, like to even just get across the $200 million mark was a big deal. And so certainly that's a reflection of our own expectations for what these sales need to be have ratcheted over the years. And so they're putting up big numbers.
Right.
And then within that, some artists had an amazing sale and then some just did terribly. So that's something we can get into, but that's
that terrible series of sales in the fall of 2008 when sell-through rates were around the 50-60% rate.
Yeah.
So with the evening sales coming in an uncertain time, it's certainly not 2008 all over again. Let's be clear about that. But to come in with sell-through rates that were in the 80s and 90s percent range, that's great.
Yeah. I mean, so I always go by the rule of thumb that the sell-through rate almost syncs with like the letter grade that you would get in school, right? So 70% is passing. It's not great. You got to see.
Right.
B is 80%. Okay. 90% above, you're doing great. And so I went back and looked. Obviously, we've just said that like the evening sales did great across the board.
Right.
But when I went back through and looked, I thought it is helpful to see sort of how do things go in the middle. And let's take Phillips, which would be maybe the more vulnerable house. It's the third biggest, but it's also, you know, it gets what the other two big guys don't get, let's say. And their sale together was 82% by lot.
Right.
So, you know what I mean? That's a B. It's definitely going to be a lower sell through than some years, but it's still in the 80s. And then Sotheby's, let's see, you know, their post-war and contemporary day sale was 82% again, right, by Lott.
Yep.
The worst one that they had were their impressionist and modern day sales and works on paper, which was 79% by Lott. So again, yeah, this is kind of nerdy and weedy, but it is helpful to sort of read what's happening that's not a part of the theatrics, yeah, that's just the grinding out of moving the material. Yeah. And they are selling, again, in the 70s, it's not great, but it's the high 70s. So I think, again, for the market that we're in, it's not a free fall.
Right.
You know, they probably are relieved that they sold that much, frankly.
Yeah, I think they are.
I'm being told, at least within the halls of Christie's, that relief is like the palpable word. They hit their target. Right. They were worried without Landau that they wouldn't, and they did. So,
they did.
You know,
and
props.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think also those day sales are indicative of the broader marketplace because they reflect more realistic, more clearly what's being sold in London and Paris and other auction centers. So they are a good thing to mention, because sometimes people focus too much on the evening sales and neglect the bulk of the market.
And they're less manipulated, right? The day sales are less, they're just less futzed with. There's fewer guarantees. There are fewer financial incentives for the auction house to sort of push them and to find third-party investors to stake them. And so it really is a more realistic sort of look at sort of market demand. And so, you know, they sold above, I think the lowest day sale result I saw was in the lower 70s, was like a day sale, an impressionist day sale, right? And Sotheby's was, I think, around 73. But still, I mean, that's probably a really real reflection. Prices are probably on the whole, if I were to throw a dart, I would say they're probably prices on the whole are down about maybe a third across the board, which does reflect accurately the toll that the market has taken. We were beating expectations for so long with inflation and everything else. And now with wars on multiple fronts, you know, we have a war in Europe, we have a war in the Middle East, this sort of dire geopolitical circumstances. Yeah. China's still trying to figure out where its economy is going to go. There's some major
interest rates.
Yeah, there's some major, you know, people are sort of tired of not being able to afford to buy the things that they want to buy. But then on the other hand, like the stock market isn't doing terribly.
Correct.
You know, people probably are going to get a Christmas bonus. You know, they are still sending their kids to private school. There's not a
realignment
feeling across the country, at least in the States, the same way there was in 2008 when we really felt like we were about to fall off a cliff. Well, you know, we're not. So
I think that having the perspective of living through 2008, 2009 changes your perspective of now. I think people who haven't lived through 2008, 2009 are perhaps either completely oblivious to the possibility of that or over exaggerate what could happen because they don't see the difference, that this is not as bad. This is a much lesser realignment and readjustment. And some would argue, I'd be curious to know what you think, that it is maybe a healthy thing for the art market, that these pauses are maybe healthy for people to readjust, realign, rethink, that just going up, 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 up sometimes cannot be a constructive thing for the underlying financial and business health of the art market.
Right. Like, especially for the millennials and the you know, the ones at the end of the alphabet, all the Gen X's and beyond, right? And it's really helpful to remember that, you know, what goes up must come down. I feel like we learned that during the NFT boom and bust, but I guess if you didn't learn that, if you didn't lose some money on crypto, like this is your second reminder of like things change. But I think it's a very helpful reminder too that these moments also beget sometimes differences in taste.
Right.
And there's certainly a different look of sort of what feels safe in this market moment and what feels speculative and sketchy. And I think we also learn a lot from these sales on which places people pivot where they feel safe. And those always change, right?
Right.
Like again, in 2008, 2009, everyone felt safe buying $200 million worth of Damien Hirst, you know, polka dots. And they felt really great buying Giacometti and Rothko and Bacon. And you felt like they were these stalwarts of the market that weren't going anywhere. And if you look at the sales, this like Rothko didn't have an amazing week. I mean, Bacon had like one or two bidders on like
Rothko was
like
a big loser.
And you look at like, you know, there are some European modernists like Kees Van Dongen and whatever didn't great. Thomas Hart Benton didn't have a great year. Mark Bradford. Like, did not have a great week. He's an amazing artist, but like at auction, not so great. You know, Magritte's were getting pulled. It's very interesting to see where they feel the pockets of safety and what felt, you know, like even Kerry James Marshall, let's be real, like didn't have the best show. I do think that we see that one element that we thought was like was being criticized as being a fad, right? This sort of championing of women, championing of artists of color, those sort of endured and persevered throughout these sales and certainly weathered that reckoning beautifully.
Right.
We saw huge prices being paid for Joan Mitchell, even Joan Snyder out of the Reitman collection.
Right.
She did great. Yep. You know, all the young girls that were just sort of coming in, they're always kind of fun and sort of hot because they're new to the market, but they did great. Like you did not see a retreat from them. Julie Murray too, I think, set a record.
Yep.
Gosh, that Barbara Chase Ribot, you know, was a name I didn't even honestly know as much. I thought she was, you know, the Sally Hemings author, but now she's a sculptor too.
Right.
And so there's all these little discovery moments that happen in the sales. And I think those taste changes, those cycle differently every time.
Right.
And it's always really fun for me to go back and Monday morning quarterback, sort of who weathered and who didn't.
I think that's that you're making a very important point here, because this issue of trends in the art market, that even from fall to spring, you'll get one artist being in and artist being out. And it's for those of us who've been around for a while, it sort of becomes a pattern that you recognize. And that's the part of the market where the people who are the most speculative in their behavior tend to deal. So I think the conclusion you seem to be drawing or pointing towards is that this time it's different, that this trend may be indicative of a larger social change in pursuing artists, women artists and artists of color and whatnot, that this may be a trend that's here to stay, that it's not a fad that's running from season to season.
Oh, certainly. I mean, I think we still have a huge long way to go in terms of, you know, I mean, I've talked with the great shout out to Charlotte Burns. They're still tracking sort of how few women enter into museums. Collections and Julie Halperin, they're always reminding us, right, that we have a long way to go.
Yeah.
But I think when you have women representing 45% of an evening sale, that's certainly not what we're used to, and I don't see that changing. The mix of which women and which artists of color are the flavor of the month, I think, is sort of where we're headed, right? And I do feel like the auction houses are under enormous pressure to keep up with that churn. I feel like in the same way that fashion cycles are churning more quickly, I feel like we're definitely seeing a faster churn through in sort of, you know, who we see. It's always very fun to sort of look back and see who was the bright, shiny penny, you know, of even three seasons ago or two seasons ago. And you're kind of shocked at like, where are they now, right? Phillips always had a ton of cause, you know, works. Like, where was cause? Like, maybe he was there, but like, he wasn't a noticeable part of it, right? Like, it's going to take me a minute to think about who I didn't see this season. But certainly, you know, there are quite a few. I feel like you didn't see a ton of Christopher Wool. His market is always a little volatile. There were even seasons when Warhol was sort of considered to be kind of, you know, passe. And now he sort of held his own. But that 16 Jackies at one of the sales didn't do great this time. He did fine. But like, a Jackie doesn't go great. That's telling. So I think you don't want to draw too many conclusions about every set, but it is, you know, a twice a year, four times a year thing. And certainly everyone wants to be in New York. If anything, in the retrenching, we've learned that like London has sort of taken a hit. Hong Kong has taken a hit. All eyes are on New York. And so these sales and these, you know, how the artists fare, for better and worse, right, really matter. And so you can say that it's an overread to sort of question, you know, why Thomas Hart Benton isn't doing great. But I think it does matter. And it does, I think, certainly the dealers and the collectors who hold these pieces, if they care, you know, they're following them very closely. Yeah.
Now, you made an interesting point about which artists of color and which female artists will change from time to time, which I think is a very good observation. And I happened to be at an interview last night between Darren Walker of the Ford Foundation and Rashid Johnson. And he made this very interesting point that for artists of color, the chronology of that art is still out of whack, that people are drawn to him who don't know Sam Gilliam or Glenn Ligon, who inspired him. And so if they're buying him or interested in him, but don't yet know or understand Sam Gilliam, there's something's out of whack. And so that the collecting community kind of needs to catch up in the history and the chronology of these new sectors that they're participating in. And they're not yet, some of them are fully up to speed.
But isn't that fascinating, because it's not the market's job to reset that canon, right?
Yeah.
That should come from
the museums
and galleries or the education forces. The market's the market's the blood sport brawl. And I think that's where collectors can find opportunities. If you know that canon, if you know that history, you're in a much better position to pounce on the piece that maybe other people aren't looking at or that you're really going to go for it. I mentioned that Barbara Chase Ribot, you know, gal, she's represented now by Hauser and Wirth. You know, yeah. Most people probably for a long time knew her primarily as the author of the Sally Hemings book back right. in the late 70s. She's also a poet. She had this cool piece called, coming up, Amnesia, and it sold for like 5 times the record. It was like 80 to 120. It sold for in the 650. So like there clearly, and if you were watching it in the sale, you could really feel the room be like, oh, we were behind the uptake on this. Like there were a group of collectors that knew what that was and they knew the rarity of it. They know she's in Glenstone. They know she's collected by the Met. She's rarely up at auction. Like they went for it. And so there is a storyline being told within the chronology, right, of artists. There is a conversation. If you know your history, you're going to be able to play.
Yep.
If you don't, then, you know, if you are the sucker, if you don't know who they are, it is probably you. Is sort of that dynamic is still true in good markets and bad. So I would say for collectors who know their history, this could actually be a really fun time to collect. I mean, I remember years where, you know, Eli Broad was absolutely the most active right in seasons like this where prices, you know, some of the shine had come off, some of the froth had come off, but there were also pieces that he was like, oh, this is a great buy, right? And he went to town all day long. You used to see Lawrence Graff do the same, remember? Like these guys who knew the market would absolutely go to town. And so I think that requires some confidence and it also requires knowing your stuff.
And a long-term vision. I mean, I remember before even them in the 90s when I was at Sotheby's, the Neimans were... Mm-hmm. major players in supporting the impressionist and modern market. And they bought a significant number of works in sales that otherwise were unlikely to go unsold and amassed one of the greatest inventories in the history of the art market. And they were visionaries to do that. Then those are the collectors that keep the market turning through good times and bad.
Yeah.
They have that long-term vision and patience.
Yeah. I mean, they're dealers too. So they, you know, inside information is like forbidden in most markets. It's absolutely
except
allowed
ours.
Here. Yeah. So here
ours.
It's like you, if you don't have insider information, you're getting screwed over. So
let's talk about Asia, which, you know, a lot of people are watching that market now because China is not living up to previous expectations and has adjusted their growth rate drastically from what it used to be. So instead of in the 8%, it's now in the, I think, 3 or 4% or 2% even possibly.
Wow.
And there are concerns by the investor class over there, the entrepreneurial class, that they're not being supported by the current government. But a lot of people have been speculating, where would they be in these fall sales? Would they be the stopgap as they have been in other times when the American collectors have pulled back? Would they step in? And so do you think that question was answered? Or do you think the jury's still out? What was your take from the evening sales?
Let me turn in my hymnal here, if you'll allow me, because I tried to keep some track of some things. But I remember very distinctly being pleasantly surprised in Christie's 20th Century sale, which I remember there were years where they took home half of the top 10.
Yeah.
You know, works.
Yeah.
Don't think that was the case here, but they did get the Femme Endormie, you know, the very pretty rainbow candy colored Picasso.
Yeah.
The hammer price on that was 37 and the estimate was 25 to 35. So certainly, you know, they showed up for that piece. I feel like they bought the Joan Mitchell again at Christie's. Mm-hmm. I feel like I saw a lot of bidding not only from Hong Kong, but also from Singapore and even like the Philippines.
Really?
I felt like I saw this would be the year where the Philippines and Singapore kind of stood out to me more actively than in years past. It wasn't a ton of mainland, although it's not to say that they weren't present, but I do remember that. Let me see if I can turn to.
And I've heard some of my Asian contacts say that you have to distinguish also, even though it's Hong Kong is part of mainland China, Hong Kong-based collectors versus mainland collectors still are very different groups of individuals with different behavior patterns, that the Hong Kong Chinese will collect differently than the mainland Chinese and perhaps are less affected by the problems in the mainland, even though their homeland is connected now to mainland China.
What's kind of wincing for me is that you see the auction houses have put a huge amount of investment in their physical brick and mortar spaces in Hong Kong and in Shanghai and the last years. It's almost like they were a little bit behind the eight ball mm-hmm. when everyone wanted to be there. And now that the West is a little bit more nervous to go, they're like, wait, we're open for shopping. Right. We just put a bow on it. Like right. we have right. this beautiful space, but like, I don't know when I will be allowed as a reporter, very candidly from the Wall Street Journal. I don't know that I'll be allowed into Shanghai.
Oh, yes,
like
of course,
they kicked
yeah.
us all out. So like, I've right. got to go to Hong Kong. And that has made the way for, I think, more interest to be paid to what's happening in Singapore and in Seoul. There's also just some education happening in the West part of like, look, you know, it's not all just mainland China. They're a huge force. You see Patty Wong was bidding quite a bit.
Right.
So I won't say that the era of mainland China is over by any stretch. You would, right. would be stupid to underestimate them. But I do think that the heat is somewhat spread right, across the right. region more. Those younger collectors who are outside of mainland China will be sort of a force to watch.
Right.
The extent to which they, as they undergo, for them, it's even more brutal. You know, this
yeah.
first moment of like, wait, China isn't just on the up and up. Like, what do we right. do with that? So the extent to which they hang in and double down on the collections that they've started or just cash out because right. they're freaked out. I think that's why the Long Museum sale
yeah. Yeah.
was so telling because, man, they were considered to be one of the few sure bets in China
yeah.
that they were buying. And they have not closed their space. They, you know, they have two spaces. I think they have sort of, I believe, shelved for the time, the third. But, you know, they're in it, but they're selling off a lot of work. And that yeah. sale was pretty brutal.
Brutal.
Pretty brutal.
And
so
I've heard,
it wasn't reassuring.
No, it wasn't. And I heard, you know, it sort of cast a pall over the sales just this last couple of days
yeah.
in Hong Kong at Christie's
yeah.
and whatnot. So.
Yeah.
It's had a long shadow over that market this season.
I think it will require more than just the theatrics and the glitter, right? That the
right.
auction houses can spray into the air to sort of reassure people that things are fine.
Right.
I feel like the Chinese people, though, have now lived with art long enough and they've joined this party for long enough that they're going to be loath to give it up entirely. They might just be buying more in Paris when they go. It doesn't hurt to, again, sort of have a sit it out moment for three right. or 4 years. There are some of the guys who I used to hang out with in the very early ages, you know, of them buying in that first and second generation, you know, the Beijing car dealers
right.
and stuff like that. They're still buying wine. They're still
right.
buying a few things. They've kind of become a little bit more discriminating. And so whether or not we can rely on them to come in with their capes and sort of save the day, I think that's where I would be hesitant.
Little,
I
yeah.
mean, you're probably going to see some reverting to the Americans on that. The Americans have always been pretty tried and true.
Yep.
And I think we're presenting ourselves as a little bit more adventurous and giddy
yep.
than anywhere in Europe. Certainly
right.
the mood is pretty gloomy over there. So I think
yeah.
America's where you got to put your bets now.
I think you're right. And I think that could be the case for quite a few years to come.
Mm-hmm.
There don't seem to be any contrary indications in economic readings of the marketplace. You know, it's interesting also when you talk about the Asian market, Chinese collectors, mainland Chinese collectors, it's interesting to note how new they are to the market. I mean, they really only entered the market in force in the early 2000s. And then it was mostly buying Chinese works of art, historic Chinese works of art that they were repatriating. I remember being in an auction house then and hearing opinions that, well, won't it be fantastic when we can get those collectors to move into Western art? But at the time, it was thought to be a long-term perspective or a long-term goal. And then in the course of maybe 12 or 15 years, they became a major force in contemporary and modern and impressionist. I mean, so their learning curve was incredibly steep and sort of unparalleled in recent memory of history of collecting in the world.
And so much fun to watch, right?
Yeah,
like for an art market that had sort of adjusted to Cologne and London with New York being the crazy upstart
right.
and who even cared about what was being sold in LA. Like
right.
now it's all just been upended in such beautiful, more democratic kind of ways.
Yes,
like
yeah.
everyone's at the chessboard. Everyone's playing.
Exactly.
And I think the fact that there's still more sort of evolution to happen, right? Like
right.
we see them paying, you know, as much for a Ming vase as a Monet, but you don't see the West yet paying, you know, as much for a Ming vase as a Monet. So there's still some
yeah.
like some tussling happening about which art gets those trophy price
right.
levels and which don't.
Right.
And I think that sort of push-pull of which of their artists are we really going to let in, so to speak. I mean, there's still a question of inclusivity, right? How much are we willing
yes.
in the West to
yes.
learn
yes.
the nuances of their taste? I think it's still worth knowing, you know, and there are these these, again, these sort of millennials in Hong Kong who love all these artists from Spain. Right. You know, you see this with the Calle, like they're paying these really cool prices. Right. And I still, again, I sort of feel out of the loop. I'm like, well, what's the deal? Like, why do you guys love these guys? Like, there's little micro stories and microcosms happening within the Asian art market that are still, I think, worth burrowing into and learning and evolving.
I agree with you. And I've heard from some of my friends over there that they don't necessarily feel as included. They don't have as many options as Western buyers do, that they don't get first access to certain artists. Mm. They don't get first access to financing and other options that Western collectors do, particularly American-based collectors. So I'm not sure we're fully there yet to a world of full inclusion and a level playing field.
So it's still a little bit gross. But I think they just need to hang in.
Absolutely.
And most people sort of greedily will follow the money eventually. I'm sad for them for that reason, because it should be a better world. But, you know, eventually they hang in there.
But we've made progress.
Hopefully.
So talking about that generational shift in things, I want to go back to that image on Instagram of you standing with Yusi. And we've talked a little bit about that previously.
Yusi Buchanan, the Christie's, longtime Christie's auctioneer.
Who had been head auctioneer there, taking all of the premier sales for probably the last 20 plus years, or maybe longer. Christopher Burge, I think, stepped down in 2009 or so. So he filled the august shoes of big shoes of Christopher Burge, who had been around since the 80s, actually. Yeah. So, and Yusi was a great guy and was a great auctioneer. And now the mantle is passing on. And is this a generational shift? Do you think that this signals other changes in the art market, of a passing of the baton to the millennials and the Gen Xers and the new, say, the new auctioneer at Sotheby's, the female auctioneer, Phyllis Cao?
Rock star. She had a huge debut. I think it's worth chewing over, mainly because it really speaks to the question of how loyal or wedded are these young collectors who came in online during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Like, who do they connect with at these houses, right? Like, I'm learning that there's been so much turnover staff-wise, certainly at Sotheby's since they got bought, you know, by Drahi. And even within Christie's, there's less turnover, but there's still just like this huge generational shift with Yusi going, that it does make you wonder, like, are the auction houses, how are they then going to maintain this sort of decades-long loyalty and sort of clubby lunch rapport that they had with the baby boomers and with the post-war collectors? That's the whole thing, is they've been taught, like, oh, you make friends with them, you maintain these friendships for decades, and then when the time comes, they're going to put up their property for sale, right? But if the millennials didn't come into the auction house and shake hands with a guy and become friends with them, if they came in online, they automatically have less like loyalty, right? They're going to many websites and buying art. And then if they go into the room and they don't really connect with, you know, the older British or German or, you know, Finnish guy up there, you know, maybe they don't feel super loyal one way or the other about where they buy and sell their art. So I do think the auction houses have been under a little bit of a crunch to put new faces into the mix. Yusi's leaving of his own accord. He's a huge legend. He will be missed. I do think he was a huge mentor, certainly to the younger, at Christie's, and much loved. And I do think that it does beg the question, who is sort of the impresario, right, of the moment in his wake? Oliver Barker is very friendly and pleasant and happy, and he's based in London. And so I think there is an opportunity across both houses to sort of push new people forward. And certainly, this gal that you just mentioned, Phyllis Cao, had a huge debut, the Sotheby's Now sale. Now, she didn't have a huge sale to take. It was only 19 lots or something, but she sold them all. And more than that, she did just seem to sort of own that room and oversee the bidding with sort of a relaxed, seasoned air that belied her years. She's relatively young. I think it was a big deal in Asia that she had sort of made.
First Asian woman to take an evening auction.
And she banned it. She took it. She filled it a few bids in Manorum, like a little, you know, like a rock star. And we all kind of, you know, chuckled here because, oh, you're doing that in New York. But like, why not? Why not? I mean, she's talking to a Chinese specialist. So I think she's going to be a fun person to watch. And it will be interesting to see if these younger collectors connect with her and with, you know, some of the other women, even at Christie's. They're trying to, you know, they're bringing in Georgina Hilton, who used to only take on the Hong Kong sales. Now you see her more in the evening sales here. So there's some generational change, I think, happening at the houses where they're trying to be as my kids like to say, young, hip, and modern. They're right. probably making right. fun of me when I say young, hip, and modern. But they are trying. I mean, I think you've got to evolve or die, right? In right. any industry. Absolutely. And that's, you know, how you capture the next generation's,
right.
you know, well, cool is you, part
you,
of the goal.
You talk about this reliance on technology by millennials to buy art. And something having been an art fair producer for a number of years, I lived through this transition with our dealer clients, that with them becoming very unhappy with some of the changes, because in the old days, the dealers, their main role as that distinguishes them from the auction houses is one of education and teacher, because they have the time to basically work at the retail level to educate people client by client, mm-hmm. individual by individual, and mm-hmm. build a new class of collectors. And so it used to be, in the old days, like pre-iPhone, that people would go into a stand at an art fair and they would like something. The dealer would come up and then tell them the story behind the thing and whatnot. And then eventually they would come around to buy it. Nowadays, the standard practice is that someone walks in with their iPhone or whatever, their Android, and takes a photograph of the piece and a photograph of the label, if there is one. And then they go home, they leave the booth without talking to the dealer, and then they go away and research it, and then we'll come back and make their purchase. So it's very disheartening for dealers because they're deprived of one of the great joys. And one of the reasons some of them got into the business was to educate and share in that love of the physical object.
And recruit.
And recruit. Yes.
Make an impression, right?
Exactly.
Invite them to dinner. Right?
And form
yeah.
a bond.
Yeah, yeah.
And help build a
yeah.
collection.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are positive changes from technology and negative ones. And so we'll mm-hmm. see how this all ultimately shakes out. Maybe, you know, the next phase will be millennials saying, okay, enough of this. I want more mm-hmm. hands-on experiences, more face-to-face experiences. Who knows? We yeah. can't predict the future that well.
We are seeing more QR codes yeah. on art fair booth wall, yeah. which I think is also just, again, the dealer's smart way of saying, like, okay, how can I at least pass on some information
yes,
about
exactly.
this artist? And that is a smart, that's
and
a smart way to
narrative.
Do it. Yeah,
and,
yeah. And we'll send you all the information about our artists in this little QR code. We'll see
yeah.
if you take the bait. Yeah. Yeah.
So before I ask you my final, very special question, I just want to think, is there anything that you want to cover or say about the art market right now, past, present, or future, that strikes you that we haven't talked about yet today?
I mean, I think it's a really fun time to be collecting. We've been talking a lot about selling work, but I think if I were a young collector, what a fun ride, right? Like the canon is not locked in anymore, right?
Yeah.
And the fact that you could play a role in upending it by supporting an artist, either young or rediscovering an old one. Like look at even just Lynn Drexler, right? Like, you know, Carmen Herrera, there are artists who we sort of had written off and are now like rediscovering.
Right.
And that kind of, you know, contemporary archaeology must be a ride and fun if you have the intellectual curiosity to do it.
Right.
But the fact that you don't have to just take your cues, you know, from what, you know, a bunch of guys back in the 50s and 60s decided, that's not as much fun as, you know, starting your own sort of IPO of what you want to buy. I think that was what was part of the joy of the NFT craze, which got sort of bogged down by basically baseball memorabilia, right? Like all those Bulls and Bears and whatever, it got a little bit muddied. But
it's not gone away.
No.
There's still private sales taking place.
Absolutely. And you still see, you know, MoMA buying Rafik Anadol, and you see Jerry Saltz sparking a whole like hot mess debate over it. I mean, I think critics and artists should be debating where art should go. That process is still happening. Young artists are still trying to push against whatever is considered sort of fusty and passe by the old. Like that continuum still happens. It's a really fun cocktail party to join intellectually and metaphysically. And I think for collectors to resist the urge just to be cynical about it, right? And just say, oh, it's all a racket, it's all of this. It can be that. It can't, you know, there are dealers who hang up a painting in a booth and it changes ownership several times over the course of a fair, right?
Exactly.
And you feel sorry for the last guy because you're like, okay, you paid a real premium price there. You didn't even know all the shenanigans that took place behind.
I know.
Like,
so
it
few
is,
people realize what goes on behind
is,
the scenes
it
there.
It is three card money. So I'm not going to say that it's not, but it's also so much more fun than hanging a stock certificate on your wall. It's a really fun tribe of people to follow around the world. I mean, like everyone else, right? I'm going to Art Basel, Miami Beach. I'm going to see as much art as I can possibly see. That's a nice way to work. It's a nice way to spend the week. So I'm a lucky girl.
I agree. Keeping one's optimism in a world that sometimes challenges that and avoiding cynicism is key to keeping one's mind fresh and engaged and one's spirit intact. I have a friend who is an American paintings dealer now in his 90s, and he is extraordinary. He brings so much joy and passion to his work on a day-to-day basis because, and I believe he is so lively and youthful for a man in his 90s because of art and because of looking on the optimistic, bright side, the passionate side of falling in love with pieces like every day, new pieces every day. That's a very special thing.
Cynicism is the enemy of curiosity, and I'm paid to be curious, so I can't afford to be cynical.
Well said. Well said. And now I'm going to ask you my grab and run question. And I'm not only going to be asking this of all my guests, and you're the first one asking it of.
All right.
I'm also going to throw it out there to our listeners because it's a good exercise to go through to sort of distill in your own mind what is a priority for you.
Okay.
So thinking about that terrific Donna Tartt book, The Goldfinch, where the protagonist actually saved a painting out of the Met during a bombing, the Metropolitan Museum of Art. In the museum of your mind, what is your grab and run piece, the one that haunts you or lives on in the forefront of your memory?
Okay. The Pulitzer that I probably will never win would be mine if I could have solved the Isabella Stewart Gardner heist story. Netflix and untold cops have spent their entire careers trying to riddle out what happened in 1990 when two thieves stole upwards of $500 million worth of art from the Gardner Museum in Boston. Every time I go to that city, I pay tribute to that museum because there's still such really great stuff there. I mean, it's chock-a-block on every wall. But I am haunted by the one picture that I can't see. And it's honestly not the Vermeer. It should be the Vermeer because there's so few of them. But the Rembrandt, Storms on the Sea of Galilee, is the picture that I ache to see. It's his only seascape. Was really an early work by him that shows the apostles sort of upended in the water on a stormy sea. And they're waiting for Jesus to come and just speak the word and calm everything. And you just, even on the JPEG, right? It gives me chills.
Yeah.
And so every time I go into that room and it's just a green piece of silk brocade, you know, behind the frame, I wince a little bit because I miss my chance to see it. Yeah. You know, it was stolen in 1990. I was still like in middle school or high school then. Like I didn't get my shot. And now that it's gone, I don't know that I'll ever get a chance to see it. And I do feel like there's something really poignant about the piece that I can't see. I realize there's layers of irony because I'm suggesting that I would go and pre-steal it. But if I were a time traveler, I would go back to like late 1989 and I would just like put it in storage, like take it down for conservation. Maybe all of them I would do. I would pre-steal it if I could time travel, but certainly the Rembrandt would be the one that
maybe you can put that into novel form in your next career as an art novelist.
Yeah. Give Donna Tartt another run
for the money. So.
The seascape. Yeah, we'll see. To be continued.
Yes. Thank you, Kelly. That was a thoughtful and provocative answer and a thoughtful and provocative interview. So thank you for all of that.
You're welcome. That was fun.
And listeners, I ask you to follow up with us on your own, and we will share some of them in future podcasts, your recommendations for your grab and run pieces. And thank you, Kelly, for such wonderful insights on this most recent season as we bring 2023 to a close. I want to thank the Wall Street Journal and Dow Jones for making Kelly available to us. To Newsstand Studios for the recording facilities here at Rockefeller Center and their terrific editing. The information and views expressed by the host and guests in this episode are solely their own and are not necessarily those of Christie's Education, but were provided for illustrative and educational purposes. Christie's Education is the only academic institution wholly owned by an auction house. Our programs have been developed to provide focused and intensive training for students looking for a career in the art world, or for art collectors to develop a deeper understanding of the art markets. As one of the major art centers in the world, New York is the ideal place to study modern and contemporary art and the art business. Our central location in Rockefeller Center gives students unique access to the art world. From Christie's Auction House to public and private collections, we provide a hands-on approach to studying inside and outside of the classroom and learn the business of art directly from art world professionals. For me, Michael Plummer, you can learn more about my 40 years of experience at the auction houses, founding and managing the art fair, TAFEF New York, and my experience in art finance on LinkedIn. I currently teach regularly at Christie's Education. Follow along with ongoing trends at Christie's Education, online at education.christies.com, and on Instagram at education.christies. Thank you for listening and see you soon.